Tikkun Olam literally means repair the world. It's an idea that Jewish radicals in the 70s and 80s really lifted out of context and popularized. They've appropriated this phrase and concept that appears in various different guises in the Talmud, in rabbinic writings, in Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, in Jewish prayer, and they've lifted it out of context and given it this meaning, social justice. So they were doing the social justice activism for many decades already in the community, but then they decided to get this kind of Hebraic appellation, and they've taken Tikkun Olam. There's no basis for this attachment of this phrase to social justice. There's no basis for it in the Jewish canon or the Jewish tradition. So here you have this Tikkun Olam movement that's saying the politics that you all believe is also what Judaism believes. So your politics are essentially a substitute for your religion. Judaism has basically become a wing of the Democratic Party, and Jewish ritual is political campaigning. That's how you do worship. You go out onto the street and you protest.
I'm Ben Weingarten, and this is Big Ideas with Ben Weingarten, a podcast where we talk with exceptional thinkers and doers about the most important ideas and issues of our time and all time. In this week's episode, my guest is Jonathan Neumann. By way of background, Neumann is a graduate of Cambridge University and the London School of Economics. He's written for various American, British, and Israeli publications, was the Tikva Fellow at Commentary Magazine, and has served as assistant editor at Jewish Ideas Daily. But most importantly, for our purposes, Jonathan has written perhaps the seminal book, titled To Heal the World, on how modern non-Orthodox Jewry has supplanted its traditional values and principles with leftism. Stated differently, leftism is the religion for the vast majority of non-Orthodox Jews, who make up the vast majority of Jews in America. As Jonathan argues, this pervasive leftism derives from perverse, sophistic, and baseless reading of the concept of Tikkun Olam, healing the world, that demands devotion to social justice as the highest good and organizing principle of the Jewish religion. Jonathan debunks the idea that Judaism is equivalent to leftism and that Tikkun Olam itself can be used to justify a leftism based in Judaism. Whether you're Jewish or not, I think you'll find our conversation to be incredibly revelatory and clarifying. For non-Jews, I get asked all the time, why are American Jews so liberal, even when it goes against their own interests, even when the Democratic Party's leading lights take an actively hostile position towards Israel and a conciliatory one towards its mortal enemies? And for American Jews, and non-Orthodox Jews in particular, I believe Neumann's arguments, if appreciated, could have nothing short of a revolutionary impact in showing just how religiously unjustifiable and practically destructive Tikkun Olamism is. So I had Neumann on the podcast to discuss these issues and many more. If you like the conversation you're about to hear and you find it valuable, I hope you'll consider subscribing to, rating, and reviewing the podcast in the iTunes store or wherever else you're listening to us. And if you want to find out more about the show, you can visit our website at benweingarten.com/bigideas, where you can find this transcript and those of many of our other episodes, and follow me on Twitter at @BHWeingarten. And now, without further ado, my conversation with Jonathan Neumann. Jonathan, in this book, you discuss the concept of Tikkun Olam as the seminal ethos, essentially, for non-Orthodox Jews. And to understand how Tikkun Olam, and we'll define that concept momentarily, became the social justice leftist Judaism that we have in America and much of the world today, again, among non-Orthodox, you have to understand the religious tradition from which it came. And you walk through the history of Judaism from roughly the mid-1800s to now and its link to Tikkun Olam. Give us that background.
So it essentially starts with German Jewry in, as you say, the early mid-19th century. And they are living in a society that is permeated with kind of Kantian ethics. And they're looking for a way to be more German, kind of retain some kind of Jewish identity, but to stick out a lot less. They don't go quite as far as the assimilationists and those who are looking to convert. They're not kind of going down the revolutionary direction of socialism. And they also are very much rejecting the kind of traditionalist rejection of modernity, or for that subset of traditionalists who are engaging with modernity but are very much keeping the rituals and the dream of returning to Zion eventually, which is a key part of it. So these German reformers, as they became known, are kind of abandoning Jewish ritual or adapting it to kind of more contemporary needs. And they drop this idea of returning to Zion. For them, Germany is the new promised land. Berlin is the new Zion. They're not looking to go back to the land of Israel. They're not looking to rebuild the temple or to restart a sacrificial order. And then this ideology then gets transplanted to America, gets exported to America as some of these German reformers emigrate to the United States. And here, too, you get also that kind of abandonment of or adaptation of traditional practices. So, for example, Saturday morning services, Sabbath services, which are the main kind of religious Jewish service in the week in the synagogue, gets moved to a Sunday in a lot of Reform temples. And even the use of the word temple instead of synagogue is a kind of a shift away from the idea that the temple belongs in Jerusalem, that actually these synagogues are kind of new temples here in America or in Germany, wherever it is. So they drop the ritual, they drop the idea of Zion, and in its place, they kind of have this Kantian ethical idea. And they bring that to the United States, and that starts to get kind of more and more political. At first, in kind of the late 1800s, it starts as a kind of abstract idea of thinking about a better society in some future time that you're kind of hoping for. And then they get influenced by a movement called the Social Gospel in the United States in the very kind of late 19th century and early 20th century. The Social Gospel, as you'll know, was kind of called the conscience of progressivism. It was essentially synonymous with socialism. Some of the leaders of the Social Gospel were openly socialist, but it had a religious coloration, unlike kind of more traditional, as it were, socialism. So it was different in that respect. They considered it to be a kind of applied Christianity, that Christianity was a kind of set of theories about how man should treat their fellow man and so on. And the Social Gospel, which was political activism, kind of radical left-wing political activism, was applying that Christianity. And they brought a lot of views from Bismarck's Germany, which is where a lot of the leaders of the Social Gospel studied. And Bismarck was a pioneer of centralizing the power of the state. So they brought those ideas to the United States, and they believed that only the state would be able to create the sort of socially just society that they were seeking, and they believed that had to happen before the second coming. So they got very involved in this kind of political activism with these religious overtones, and Reform Jews got really taken by this and said, oh, actually, we should be doing this as well. And they get so into it that their zeal and ardor kind of end up surpassing even that of the Social Gospel. And that mentality has kind of stayed with this reformist tradition ever since. The Reform movement changed a lot because of World War I, which kind of collapsed a lot of the presumptions about progressivism and where society was going. And then, of course, World War II even more so, and the Holocaust particularly for the Jews. So there was a kind of shift back to more Jewish, traditionally Jewish rhetoric for the kind of things that they were doing. And that's where this phrase Tikkun Olam then started to become popular. It's obviously a Hebrew phrase, and we can talk about that. So there was a kind of shift away from what we now call classical reform back then. But the centrality of this sort of liberal political activism is still very much there in Reform and non-Orthodox Judaism.
Tikkun Olam is, in a sense, the link between a Reform movement that had become unwed from actual Jewish values and principles, and it provides, in some sense, a religious veneer for the social justice leftism that had become endemic in the non-Orthodox Jewish movement. So let's start at the very top, which is define Tikkun Olam.
So Tikkun Olam literally means repair the world, more poetically, heal the world, hence the title of my book, To Heal the World. It's an idea that Jewish radicals in particular, in kind of the 70s and 80s, really kind of lifted out of context and popularized. They've appropriated this phrase and concept that appears in various different guises in the Talmud, in rabbinic writings, in Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, in Jewish prayer. And they've lifted it out of context and given it this meaning, social justice. So they were doing the social justice activism for many decades already in the community, but then they decided to get this kind of Hebraic appellation, and they've taken Tikkun Olam. There's no basis for this attachment of this phrase to social justice. There's no basis for it in the Jewish canon or the Jewish tradition, but that's what they've done. And part of it was this way of kind of saying, oh, this is a particularly Jewish thing that we're doing, this social justice, and we're calling it Tikkun Olam.
And I wonder if you would walk through how it was that this phrase, which as you know it, and you go through in great detail in your book, has no basis actually in the text. And when it does exist in the primary Jewish text, it's been clearly perverted in its usage and its definition. I wonder if you would explain how it is that this phrase, which was barely in the sort of ether as of, call it 40 years ago, has now become the predominant descriptor of why it is that Jews imbibe and work towards imposing leftist values and principles in America, again, among non-Orthodox, which is an important distinction to make here.
Right. I mean, firstly, as you say, it is mostly amongst the non-Orthodox, but the non-Orthodox are about 85% of American Jewry. I mean, American Jewry is not a huge demographic in America, but it's a politically very active one. So this is, you know, this is quite a big phenomenon. You already started to get inklings of this interest in Tikkun Olam as a phrase before World War II. Then it started to build up a bit more after World War II, but again, very, very quietly. It was only in kind of the 70s that Jewish, what you might call kind of hippies, part of the counterculture, essentially, they kind of got into this and started using this term more and more to mean kind of leftist politics. And then particularly in the 80s, people like Arthur Waskow, Michael Lerner, and who founded Tikkun magazine in the 80s, really kind of popularized this. And these, you know, these people, someone like Arthur Waskow was involved in kind of the more militant elements of the civil rights movement, against the strong protest against the Vietnam War, and founded a think tank that was at the very least a kind of propagandist for the Soviet Union and sympathetic to its agenda. And a lot of people say actually had kind of concrete links to the Soviet Union. And Michael Lerner was part of the Seattle Seven and so on. So, you know, these people are very much part of the more general radical political milieu. They weren't particularly Jewish. Their radicalism was premised on there not really being a difference between Jews and non-Jews. So this was, you know, not a particularly Jewish endeavor that they were undertaking. But then, for whatever reason, they started to get more interested in Judaism. And the Judaism that they were interested in was this social justice Judaism of non-Orthodoxy that had been going on for several decades by the time you get to the late 60s and 70s. And then they really kind of pushed this idea forward with, as I said, publications like Tikkun magazine. And essentially, a lot of Jews, and not just in this country, around the world, are not particularly familiar with the Jewish tradition. So it's, you know, not that difficult to tell them that the Jewish tradition says certain things that it doesn't actually say. And Jews themselves have been liberal in this country for a very long time. They were already pretty liberal before FDR, but FDR was really the unifier of what was quite a kind of disparate Jewish community. They really came together, in support of his policies, in terms of his liberal policies in the New Deal, but also B, eventually as a savior of the Jewish people in World War II. So they have since essentially stuck with the Democratic Party and with liberal politics. Majority of Jews have voted for the Democratic candidate for president in every election. The only one that was anywhere near close was 1980 with Reagan and Carter, because of Carter's policies, I think, on Israel, and also generally the country, you know, was fed up of him and his administration. So the Jews have stuck with the Democratic Party throughout. So here you have this Tikkun Olam movement that's saying, oh, conveniently, the politics that you all believe is also what Judaism believes. So, you know, isn't that a nice and convenient coincidence for everyone? So your politics are essentially a substitute for your religion, and that's essentially where we've got to now. That Judaism has basically become a wing of the Democratic Party in this country. And for these people, Jewish ritual is political campaigning. That's how you do worship. You go out onto the street and you protest.
And you assert that that is a perversion of Judaism. You have a line, a very profound line in your book, and you say, and I quote, "Jewish social justice effectively has no need for Jews qua Jews." Expound upon that.
So this is part of a wider issue. Tikkun Olam is a theology of its own. In order to ground liberal politics in Judaism, for which there isn't really that the kind of basis that they think there is, they have to essentially create a whole new religion. And the way they do that is by going back to the story of creation, because that's the shared provenance of all of mankind. In traditional Judaism, the creation story is a very important teaching, but when it comes to moral obligation, the principal basis for that, in terms of the way that a Jew relates to a fellow Jew, is in Revelation, the revelation of the Torah at Mount Sinai. The reason for that is because the revelation created the Jewish people, you know, one people under God, eventually to live in its own land, in the land of Israel, which is where the Jews were journeying to in the desert. So moral obligation in Judaism is principally within the Jewish people. There are theological and historical reasons for that as well. The Jews historically have been separate from the rest of humanity, whether living in their own land or living in their own communities and ghettos and so on, sometimes out of choice, often not out of choice. So that's the basis of moral obligation for in traditional Judaism. Now, of course, there is also moral obligation for Jews outside of the Jewish community. But the best way perhaps to think about it is like a family, that people feel more obligated morally to their parents, whom they should honor, to their children, whom they should love and provide for, to their siblings, to whom they feel close, because you're kind of extensions of yourselves. It would be strange, I think, if people treated their neighbors or complete strangers with the same degree of love and affection and kind of financial provision and so on as they do their siblings or their children. I think most people would find that quite weird. So the Jewish people is also a family, not just kind of figuratively, but also the Jewish people believe itself to be the biological descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the children of Israel. Israel is a name for Jacob. The children of Israel are literally the children of Jacob and the patriarchs. So there is that familial relationship between Jews. But of course, that doesn't mean just because you treat your sibling better than strangers that you should treat strangers badly. You know, you also treat strangers well, but there is a kind of a distinction. So that is the traditional Jewish approach. The Tikkun Olam movement in its theology does away with all of that. They find the idea of Jewish peoplehood to be chauvinistic and embarrassing and a relic, and they want nothing to do with it. So they abandon all of that, and instead they want to go back to creation, which is where everybody is the same. So that is kind of fundamental to Tikkun Olam. The kind of trick that they play is to make you think that, okay, if all of humanity comes from the same place, that somehow leads to liberal politics, which it doesn't. The truth is, it doesn't lead to any politics. Some people say, well, okay, everyone is created in the image of the divine, therefore everyone deserves the same outcomes and the same economic outcomes in society. Okay, that's one reading. It's a bit of an extrapolation, but okay. But similarly, you can say, well, we should respect the dignity of hard work, the human dignity of not relying on the state or on a welfare system, not having to take from others in order to provide for yourself. So, you know, any politics can flow from creation, but certainly there's more of a kind of basis for their kind of liberal politics looking to creation than there is looking to revelation. And what's interesting is that Tikkun Olam is stridently universalistic when it comes to the Jews, but not, it seems, when it comes to everybody else. This is where it kind of gets really strange, that the only reason, really, that the Tikkun Olam movement sees for why Judaism and the Jews should continue to exist is to promote this idea of social justice. They don't even think that's a uniquely Jewish teaching, because they can't say that, because that sounds like the Jews have some kind of special role in the world, so they can't quite say that, but they have to reckon with the fact that the Jews exist, and if they want to base their views in the Hebrew Bible, then they, you know, they have to say something about why the Jewish people are here. So they kind of say that it's to promote this idea of social justice, but the Jews aren't the only ones whose role is to do that. So it's a kind of weird place. But ultimately, they don't really see a role for the Jewish people, because in a socially just society, there is no need for Jews, qua Jews, as you say. But on the other hand, the Jews never say that, or the Tikkun Olam movement, rather, never says that about African Americans or American Muslims or anyone else, that they should abandon their particular cultures and beliefs and so on. They would find it offensive if anyone were to say that. So they celebrate difference in everybody else, but what they celebrate in everybody else, they find chauvinistic in themselves, which is a very kind of strange and I think almost pathological approach.
Inextricably intertwined with this creation of a new religion, in effect, as you put it, and this idea of not wanting to be separate from everyone else, universalism and the like, is the need to create a new conception of Israel and Israel's meaning in the Jewish religion. And of course, if you read the text, the land of Israel is intrinsic to this people and this belief system. The Tikkun Olamis often come down almost universally, if you were looking at Venn diagrams of where the Tikkun Olamis are and where Zionists are, almost to a man, are universally hostile towards Israel and believe in appeasing Israel's enemies, and ultimately to, in effect, Israel's destruction, whether or not they will admit it outright or not. And this is a change historically, because in the past, as you mentioned, leftism has been a huge part of non-Orthodox Judaism, but there was a belief that Israel was the Jewish homeland and that it was worth fighting for. And there's been an inversion over time. There was a book, Turning David into Goliath, where one argument was made that Israel became the oppressive colonialist occupier, etc., when before it was an upstart surrounded by all of its enemies, very small New Jersey-sized nation with all of everything on the opponent's side and almost nothing for Israel, and a belief that Israel would be destroyed and could be destroyed at any given time. Yet it somehow survived, and now it is viewed as the evil, the Goliath. Explain how it is that Tikkun Olamis conceive Israel and their views on it generally.
American Jewish Zionism was always kind of more of a liberal bent than in kind of Russia and Eastern Europe. So going back kind of 100 years, Brandeis, Louis Brandeis, led the kind of Zionist movement in the United States and really kind of popularized it. And there was still an idea that a Jewish settlement or homeland or state in the land of Israel, it wasn't clear at the time what exactly would turn out. They kind of hoped that it would be a beacon of social justice, because they were already the community was already into that at the time. So there was always a kind of a leftist kind of coloration there, in a way that for the Eastern Europeans, who were confronting a much more immediate anti-Semitism, for them, you know, worrying about what Israel would look like was kind of a secondary issue. It was, you know, you needed to get as many Jews there as possible as soon as you could. And for the Americans, they kind of shifted briefly with the Holocaust and so on, because suddenly the immediacy of anti-Semitism also became apparent to them. But American Jewish Zionism was always on that kind of side of the ledger. But actually, where the Tikkun Olam movement comes out is not really from that tradition. It comes out again from the 1960s radicalism. And what you see is that Israel was allied to the United States, and these radicals were anti the United States, and the Arabs and the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, were allied to the Soviet Union. They were pro-Soviet Union. So it was kind of quite black and white, and that was the side that they were on. So they allied on the side of Israel's enemies. And that's the kind of milieu that today's Tikkun Olam movement has come out of. Those radicals at the time came together in the 1970s in an organization called Breira, which means in Hebrew alternative. And it was a kind of play off an Israeli adage at the time that went by En Breira, which means there is no alternative. And what Israelis were saying is there is no alternative but to prevail in the war that the Arabs were kind of perpetually inflicting upon Israel. Israel had to motivate itself to kind of fight this existential and constant conflict. They would have obviously preferred to just live their lives, but that wasn't a luxury that they had. So this organization seemed to suggest that there was such an alternative, and it seemed to consist in trying to negotiate and legitimate the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, that was engaged in kind of pioneering and unrepentant terrorism at the time, hijacking airplanes and so on, targeting Israelis and Jews worldwide, and also part of the larger pro-Soviet axis. So Brira eventually collapsed. The Jewish community wasn't prepared to tolerate, as you noted, those sorts of views on Israel. They were sympathetic to social justice more generally, but on Israel, that was still something of an exception at the time. Those radicals then got together again in the 1980s in an organization called New Jewish Agenda. And again, you had people like Michael Lerner, Arthur Waskow, but also other names as well were involved there at the time. Ruth Messenger, who was a longtime head of the American Jewish World Service. She was a Democratic nominee for the New York City mayoralty against Rudy Giuliani when he was running for a second term. Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist. Samuel Norwich, the publisher of The Forward. A whole bunch of different characters and individuals were involved in Brera. With New Jewish Agenda, unlike Brera, which was singularly focused on Israel, New Jewish Agenda diluted the focus on Israel amongst a whole bunch of other issues on the social justice agenda, race relations, the environment, nuclear weapons, and so on. New Jewish Agenda also eventually collapsed, internecine quarreling, budgetary issues, and also the Israel issue. But the people involved in it went on to found a whole bunch of different organizations, Tikkun Magazine, Americans for Peace Now, and so on. And that mentality has lived on in them as the kind of older generation of the Tikkun Olam movement today, and also in their kind of younger disciples who are now kind of carrying on their work. And it would seem that increasingly Israel is no longer an exception to the rest of the social justice agenda. And, you know, you see it in organizations like J Street, where the community is more and more prepared to tolerate the sorts of views that once upon a time they would not. And as you say, the fundamental point seems to be that Tikkun Olam has an Israel problem. The more attached you are to Tikkun Olam, the more skeptical or hostile an organization or an individual seems to be towards Israel. Part of that is political, because Israel is not popular within liberal politics, and you know, you see that in the general social justice movement. The social justice movement is not where you're going to find the pro-Israel factions in American politics. And part of it is theological, because if there's no need for a Jewish people, then there's also no need for a Jewish homeland. And actually, the diaspora becomes the real home of the Jewish people, because that's where they can pursue and apply social justice in the communities and countries in which they live. So there is a fundamental disconnect between Tikkun Olam and Zionism and the Land of Israel. And as you say, there's no basis for that in the Jewish tradition. The Land of Israel is absolutely central to what Jews are and what they're supposed to be. So that is a real problem.
Since you mentioned the political implications of all of this, and progressivism at one time was not considered an anti-Zionist sort of movement, but today clearly is, and you see it in all of its leading lights, and you see it in the leaders in the Democratic Party in America and the like. And I have a theory about why it is that Israel, which many liberal Jews in America, and I'm not talking about classical liberal Jews in America, but liberals in America, as in left liberals, have expressed fear that suddenly Israel has become a one-party issue dominated by the Republican Party. And my theory about this is as follows. Of course, there's the ideological element, which is that the left has turned anti-Zionist and the Democratic Party has become more left. As such, it is becoming a one-party issue in effect. But there's another angle to this, which is that, again, Orthodox Jews typically vote Republican in America. Non-Orthodox do not. And as the non-Orthodox become more progressive, intermarry, etc., Israel isn't a salient issue for most people on the left, Jews included. And while that non-Orthodox population shrinks due to intermarriage and low birth rates, on the other hand, the Muslim population in America expands significantly. Muslims tend to vote left, and on issues of Israel and the Middle East in general, typically take a hostile view towards Zionism and a more lenient view towards the enemies of Israel. So you have an expanding base of Muslims in America who have much higher birth rates than non-Orthodox Jews voting left. And you have a shrinking Jewish base in America, which is less and less focused on Israel as an issue. So do you see it as being in the Democrats' self-interest to actually take a less pro-Zionist view? And as such, perhaps we see it becoming a one-party issue, not because of any great conspiracy on the Republican side, but actually because there is a growing constituency in Muslims in America who take a view which is in line with the progressive view, and the non-Orthodox Jews are either going to go along with it or essentially shrink out of the population as is.
The shift to Israel becoming more and more of a, or less and less of a bipartisan issue is incredibly concerning. But something that has to be remembered is that bipartisanship can't be the end. Bipartisanship is a means to passing policy that strengthens the American-Israeli alliance and that helps Israel's security as a bastion of values that are shared by America in the Middle East. What bipartisanship has become is more and more of a kind of an ends, and that we have to make Israel a policy on Israel at the lowest common denominator to include as many Democrats as possible, because they tend to be more hostile towards Israel. So, you know, if that's what bipartisanship is, then it doesn't really help anyone. You know, you have to focus on policy, and the Republicans, as you say, at the moment, it wasn't always the case, at the moment tend to be the more pro-Israel party. Interestingly, it was less of an issue when the Democrats were the more pro-Israel party a few decades ago, because the Jews were on that side of the ledger. So now the Jewish community is having to kind of think about this. But most of them, you know, don't vote on the Israel issue. They vote on everything else. So, you know, abortion is more important to American Jews than Israel is. So, you know, they will stick with the Democratic Party, particularly the younger ones who are increasingly, as you say, sharing the animosity of the party towards Israel. But what's interesting, and we're seeing this in the Trump administration, is this kind of unprecedented involvement of more traditionalist Jews at the highest levels of American politics. And we see it most clearly in the Trump White House and its policies towards Israel, towards Iran, and etc. This is, in a sense, the culmination of a few decades of collaboration between traditionalist Jews and evangelical Christians, who have, of course, been very Zionist for a very long time. And the traditionalist community in the Jewish community is also growing. It was 10% for quite a while. It's now about 15%. And in terms of their children, as you point out, the proportions are much larger. So we are going to start seeing, I think, a shift within the Jewish community. But I think there's a lot more trouble to come, because the products of families and communities of outmarriage, of where Jews marry non-Jews. I think there's a lot of confusion there for kids who come out of those sorts of communities, and the communities themselves are very confused, because, you know, they don't require necessarily the conversion of someone who wants to marry a Jew. So what does that mean for Jewish peoplehood? And again, the connection of Jewish peoplehood to the land of Israel. If you have kind of non-Jews within the Jewish community because they've kind of married into it, what's their attachment to the land of Israel? And what's their attachment to Zionism? So those kind of families are confused. Those communities are confused. Those kids then go onto campus. They don't really know what side they're on. A lot of time, I think, this is more a question for psychologists, but it feeds a lot of, I think, hostility towards Israel as well. So I think things are going to get worse before they get better. But this kind of more muscular traditionalism in the Jewish community, I think, is something definitely to watch out for, and something that's only going to grow. I mean, as you point out, the Orthodox community in particular was one of the most staunchly pro-Trump voting constituencies in the country. So there is something to watch there. And you're seeing real results, the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, the withdrawal of the United States from the Iran deal, and so on. These are real, tangible, policy outcomes that we're seeing. So, you know, it's a really exciting time, actually, and there's a lot to look out for. But I am worried that things will get worse before they get better.
The last question that you must have grappled with as you were researching and writing this book is, as you mentioned, in America, Jews have essentially always voted Democratic, and only more so in the post-FDR era, and that legacy lives on to today. And it's not just an American phenomenon. If you look at the founding of Israel itself, many of those who founded Israel were socialists, and Israel's policies politically have remained largely socialist, though at a decreasing rate up to today under Benjamin Netanyahu's leadership. The seminal question is, why is it that Jews historically are politically left liberal? And there are any number of potential answers to this. I would suggest one might be, and you definitely see it in the concept of Tikkun Olam, a fundamental misinterpretation of the religion itself. But I wonder what your response would be to that question.
Yeah, it's a very big question. I don't think there's any one answer. A lot of ink has been spilled trying to work that out. I think in the modern age, a main part of it is that the liberal parties tended to be the most friendly towards the Jews in Europe in the last kind of couple of hundred years. So, you know, that said to Jews that actually this is the politics where we feel the most comfortable. And, you know, there are things today, issues in America today that where that mentality still perpetuated. So I'm thinking of the separation between church and state. You know, for Jews coming out of Europe, that was a very big deal because the church was the oppressor. So if you divorce the church from the state and make sure that the state is a secular power, then you've insulated yourselves from the oppression from the church. So, you know, that's something that liberal Jews kind of carry into today. Interestingly, traditionalist Jews who have the kind of the strongest psychological connection to Europe to kind of the old world are much more comfortable with religion in the public square than liberals are. But there is a basis for that, you know, for that liberal position. One can't pretend that it comes out of nowhere. Whether the interpretation needs to be so extreme, whether it's outweighed by issues like religious education, you know, which would do a lot to stem the tide of assimilation in the Jewish community. You know, it's probably outweighed by things like that, and they should rethink their opposition. But again, it's not coming out of nowhere. So that would be, you know, that would be one part of it that I think that the liberal parties are where the Jews started to feel the most comfortable. And, you know, the status quo for Jews for a long time, particularly in Europe and Russia, was very unfriendly. So, you know, the way to overcome that, a lot of the time, was revolution. And the kind of revolutions were ones where you toppled the monarchy or the aristocracy, and you replaced them with government that was accessible to everyone. So more liberal government, or more socialistic government, or communist government, and so on. So I think those are the sorts of historical trends that kind of fed into those things. Also, when it comes to the state of Israel, a lot of nation building, and even in this country, in particular, kind of in the north, you know, before the Civil War, that nation building has often relied on more kind of socialistic policies and more kind of government direction and involvement. And, you know, the north in this country was kind of protectionist, and the south didn't like that. So you kind of see that everywhere. You see that with the modern tiger economies in Asia as well. So I think that's kind of a universal. And then as societies become more affluent, the trick is to then open up kind of economically. But that's a kind of a separate question from, you know, from Judaism and where the religion is at. I think there's a lot more kind of depth and complexity and a multi-layeredness to Judaism to be able to kind of pick out one ideology and say that's, you know, that's what's going on there. Interestingly, you know, some of the critics of the book have claimed that, oh, you know, he's just saying that Judaism is not liberal so that he can say that it's conservative. And, you know, as you'll know, I don't make that argument in the book. I don't think that Judaism can be reduced to that. And I think it's kind of very telling, because people who take their faith seriously, that's whether it's Judaism or Christianity or any other faith, they they don't want to make it a handmaiden to their politics. The religion, faith, and God in the community come first. And the politics are a means to achieving those goals. Whereas for the Tikkun Olam movement, politics is the end. That is their religion. And some even said that Tikkun Olam has become their God. So it's very telling that they think that that's what's going on in my head. It's more revealing about what's going on in theirs.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please do help us out by subscribing to, rating, and reviewing Big Ideas with Ben Weingarten in the iTunes store or wherever else you're listening to us. I'm your host, Ben Weingarten. You can find out more about the podcast at benweingarten.com/bigideas or at BH Weingarten on Twitter. Thanks so much for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time.